are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
Views expressed on this program are the responsibility of those who make them. They do not necessarily represent the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or any of its affiliates.
And good evening, ladies and gentlemen, whoever you are and wherever you are, all around this beautiful planet we call Earth. Thanks for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Those of you joining us for the very, very first time, a special welcome. I'm glad you're here, and I think you're going to be glad as well. We've got a couple of things for you to enjoy as new listeners. You do not know, so let me tell you, you can go over to kevinsmithshow.com and you can subscribe to our free weekly newsletter. It's called the K-Files E-Zine. You'll see the subscription link in big red letters right in the middle of the screen. Also, not just for the new folks, but also for everybody, if you're not a member yet, be sure that you become a member. Now, you don't have to subscribe and pay a membership fee in order to hear the show. That's free. But we have some additional goodies for you in the members area. One of those is that at least once a month, I join you in the chat room. And this Saturday is the Saturday evening is the time. So I'm going to be in the chat room Saturday evening. And at what time? Well, what time is it right now where you are in your time zone? Well, that's when we start. Whatever time our show starts in your time zone, that's when you need to go to the chat room in the members area. All right? So if you're not a member yet, be sure you join and join us in the chat room on Saturday evening. Back to the K-Files for just a moment. This upcoming edition has some things in it that I think you'll be very, very interested in. You've heard me say quite often that I think the conditions on Mars are very, very different from what we have been told. And then our guest told us on January 1, Dick Criswell, that, in fact, Mars has a breathable atmosphere. Well, in the K-Files E-Zine, you're going to have a link to a video that shows a scientist, a NASA scientist, actually explaining that, and this was a long time ago, but it never got a lot of press play, but actually discovered that Mars has 15 times more oxygen than they had thought it had. We're still hearing that it has a very thin atmosphere, so virtually no atmosphere, it's so thin. And yet, in the face of that, we're still watching NASA land things on the surface of Mars by means using the means of parachutes, and those don't work without a good thick atmosphere. In the K-Files E-Zine, this edition, you will also find a link to a video that I talked about with Dick Criswell, and that video is of a purported 1962 landing on Mars. Yeah. 1962. And there's something moving out there, and you hear people saying that we have life on Mars. Is it real? I don't know, but it sure is interesting, and it's in this edition. Be sure you get subscribed, all right? Be back on the other side of this break. My guest this evening, Bob Ginsberg. Don't go away. Alien Seeker News has blasted off and is providing a new and important resource for everyone interested in UFOs, aliens, alien abductions, Bigfoot, Chupacabra, and more. Featuring five of the top UFO radio talk shows, lots of information and articles in free forums, Alien Seeker News has launched on its journey to greatness. Go to AlienSeekerNews.com, register for the free forums, and get the classic Flying Saucers Are Real by Major Donald Kehoe as a free ebook. Join today. Most of the great music you hear right here on Steel Eye Media Network is supplied by the independent artists from GarageBand.com. If you hear a song you like, go over to GarageBand.com, look it up, download it. You can even buy the group's CDs in many cases right there at GarageBand.com. Get it all. Become a member at KevinSmithShow.com.
Are you working hard to get ahead but seem to be moving backwards, not forward? Do you run into obstacles and resistance everywhere you turn? I'm Monique Chapman with 25 years' experience helping people in fulfilling their dreams. Call me today at 888-240-6057 and schedule your consultation that will assist you in making key decisions to bring your life back into balance. Check out my website for all services offered, www.healing-visions.com. Love yourself enough to make the call today, 888-240-6057.
Kevin Smith here. Do you have your Kevin Smith Show t-shirt yet? No? Well, let today be the day you step into the world of galactic fashion. Visit the Kevin Smith Show online store and get yours today.
My guest this evening is Bob Ginsberg, and he is the founder of Forever Family Foundation. We are going to be talking this evening about his work and the work of the foundation. And the big question is there life after life? And a lot of people listening to the show right now, I know because we've had shows where we've discussed that topic a little bit, and you would say, well, of course there is. Of course there's life after life. Well, it's one thing for us to have, you know, that personal anecdotal assurance or feeling or belief or whatever you want to call it. That's one thing. But what Bob went looking for and is still in the business of researching is good, solid scientific evidence that life after life is real. Bob Ginsberg, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
Well, thank you, Kevin. It's a pleasure to be with you tonight.
I was interested, quite interested, in the story of what got you started in this, and I, on purpose, left it out of what we put online because I want you to share it with us.
I'll be happy to. You know, Kevin, probably if we had a discussion 6 years ago and we were talking about life after death and some of these various phenomena, I would say, you know, when you're dead, you're dead, and that's it, and I really wasn't open to anything. And then about 5 years ago, September 1st, 2002, My wife woke me up in the morning. It must have been about 4 a.m., you know, and I said, what's the matter? And she was white as a ghost. And I said, what's the matter? She said, I don't know, but I can tell you that something horrible is going to happen today. You know, now, how seriously do you take that? I mean, there have been times in our lives, you know, we've been together 30 years, and she's never said anything like that, but there have been occasions where she said to me that something good was going to happen, specific things, and they did happen. So we decided to take it somewhat seriously, and we have three children, and we checked with them all during the day, and we sort of let our guard down, and then in the evening, my son and daughter were in a horrible car crash, and they were both severely injured. My daughter didn't survive, you know, and my son eventually recovered. And of course, you know, you're in such a state of shock for quite some time. I mean, at that point, we didn't know whether we were going to lose both of them. My son was in a coma. But, you know, as a month or two went by, and then I said to myself, wait a second. And then I remembered, you know, her waking me up, you know, in the morning. And I hadn't even thought about it because, you know, as I said, you're just really walking around in a state of bewilderment. And I said, well, how did that happen? I mean, was this a case of precognition? You know, did she see the future? Or perhaps this was a warning from somebody that was on the other side, so to speak, a warning that we couldn't quite put our finger on, and we didn't get enough specifics. But, of course, you would think, well, what if I did? You know, could I have prevented this? And it started a search. There are many, many things that my wife experienced personally, and I was sort of living vicariously through her. But I was of the left brain, you know, and I wanted somebody with an MD or a PhD after their name to tell me that this was not just, you know, a bunch of crap. And this has been researched, and this is a real phenomena. And that started the quest. I really, you know, I was almost like a stalker, you know, tracking down these various scientists, and flew out to different universities and watched them, you know, what they were doing in their laboratories, and thus began the foundation, which is a sort of a convergence of science and spirituality, where we seek to find out and educate the public about various forms of evidence. And at the same time, it's helpful to people that are bereaved, because let's face it, it's a pretty good form of grief therapy if you have the belief that you're going to see your loved one again in some form at some time.
Well, yeah. But now, this five-year trek you've been on, would you say that it either has been successful in providing you with the information you sought, or would you say it is being successful and becoming more successful? What stage is that in?
Well, I, you know, a lot of the research, when I talk about research, I'm talking about research that tends to show that our mind or our consciousness can act independently of our brains, you know, has been going on for quite some time, but you just never hear about it. I mean, for the most part, mainstream science puts the kibosh on it. They really don't want to discuss it. You know, I mean, personally, they might believe in it, they might not, but it's certainly, you know, nothing that they want to talk about or research. But there have been quite a number of experiments going back over the century with mediumship, and then later with the Pear Lab in Princeton with global consciousness. And, you know, Kevin, a lot of people sometimes, when we're interested in things like telepathy, for instance, and remote viewing, and people say, well, you know, why are you interested in that? What does that have to do with an afterlife? And, you know, my response is really, I mean, we don't know if it has something to do with the afterlife. However, if you can, all these things substantiate that our mind can act independently of our brains, so that it can transcend time and space. And if that is true, then you can make a logical leap to say that it can survive our physical death. So, you know, what stage are we in? It's always trying to uncover some of the research, and one of our goals is to help to fund the research, because it's certainly not available, funds are not available from traditional sources like the NIH and so forth. The universities that are involved in such studies rely on, you know, private donors.
When you and I talked privately on the telephone, I mentioned to you the work of Dr. Gerald Epling. And but all I mentioned to you was the work that he does with plants. Now, his day job, so to speak, his main focus, is he is a researcher in the field of memory. And one of the very interesting things that he has said on this show is that memory is a mystery, because the idea that it's stored in the brain is not supported by the science, and that our memory, nobody's really sure where it's stored, but they pretty much can say it's not stored in the brain.
Right, and I don't know if it was Epling, but I know that there have been a number of experiments done with rats and mice where they would actually train these rats to do specific tasks, and then they would physically cut out large sections of their brain, the parts of the brain that they thought would control, you know, memory. And what they were shocked to learn that the memory memories were retained. The rats would perform the same tasks even though, you know, most of their brain was gone.
Well, and I would think that that indicates, I mean, the fact that they can verify that memory exists outside the brain and they don't know exactly where, I think that would certainly indicate that consciousness is independent from the brain.
I agree. You know, a lot of scientists today talk about this. You'll hear different terms, a zero-point field, universal consciousness, the Akashic records. I mean, there's all sorts of terminology, but the premise being that there's this field of energy where consciousness can be stored and retrieved. I think that's what we're talking about.
Well, and, you know, after you and I talked, I really thought about this. And people that listen to this show all the time and have been listening for quite some time know that what we're talking about right now, consciousness and how it works and what is it, and all, is really one of my favorite topics. I'm just really interested in it. Yeah. So I really gave a lot of thought to what you and I had discussed in our private conversation. And, you know, the thought hit me, and I really can't say that this is what I think. I can't say that I think this is accurate, but the thought hit me that this whole thing may work just like our computers. That our computers were created by us, and we made them in our image, so to speak, maybe without even realizing it. So you have this field. Just consciousness permeating everything, and we'll call that the hard drive. Everything that we think and do and everything gets recorded there. But then right around us is RAM. Right around us is where our memories are stored. In that field, but ready access memory. What do you think?
You're very well maybe right. You know, a lot of common theories that I hear today, or people talk about, our universe is actually one layer, one sheet of, and these different sheets or layers are stacked upon each other. And each layer, for instance, the layer that we navigate our physical lives in, has a certain frequency. And these other layers have their own frequencies. And if you can alter the phase of the frequency, maybe one object can appear and disappear from our reality, and that might explain these glimpses that we get, where we have a sudden thought that pops into our head, or we see an apparition, or we and it's a mystery. But you know, maybe that's what the answer is. You know, it sounds logical. It's logical as anything else I've heard.
Well, pardon me. The thought struck me after we talked and I was on the computer that these things are created in our image. It was our brains. It was human brains, human mentality and intellect that created these computers. We could not possibly create something we couldn't imagine, and we cannot imagine what we have not seen.
Mm.
And therefore, the way the computer works is a crude and primitive copy of the way we work. That was the thought that hit me.
Yeah.
And therefore, maybe the way all of this consciousness and memory works is similar to what we created in the computers.
It's very well may be true. The other concept is that, just as you say, we were designed that way. Our brains were specifically designed to mimic, you know, the universe. And they talk about a holographic universe, and where you dissect one little section of it, and it contains the entire picture and the entire all facets of all the universes, and just in one little piece. So we're all connected. You talk about some scientists talk about entanglement. You know, scientists today, they take two photons and they shoot them off at the speed of light in opposite directions, and lo and behold, you know what happens to one photon is affects the other. You know, I mean, how is that possible? You know, are we all entangled? You know, as I'm talking to you, do my thoughts affect your thoughts in some way?
It gives a whole new perspective to that age-old question, am I my brother's keeper?
That's right. You know, you touched on something at the big top of the show, you know, about, you know, a belief in these things. And I've come to the opinion, you know, you could form educated opinions, but there's nothing that takes the place of personal experience. And I'll tell you another experience that I had that sort of turned the corner, you know, for me being an open-minded skeptic on these things. I had, my wife had bought a new car, and she kept telling me that it was strange, but that there was some sort of she termed it a Morse code that kept coming, she kept hearing in the car. And I asked her about it, and she said, well, you know, it had a specific cadence. It was always the same cadence and the same code, if you will. So I said, you know, a lot of cars, they always have electronic problems, you know, it's a problem with the radio. And she said, no, I don't think so. Well, then she started driving with the radio off, and then the same, you know, code would appear. So, you know, one day I was driving in the car with her, and the radio was off, and I heard it. And, you know, it was a little strange because, you know, with the radio off, how would it be coming through? Well, this thing started to mushroom, and then, you know, a couple weeks later, we switched cars one day, and she took my car, which I had been driving for 3 years, never heard anything, and lo and behold, this Morse code appears there. And then it starts to appear in, you know, our TVs when they're off, computers, you know, on or off didn't make a difference. We sponsored different lectures, and right in the middle of a lecture, we would hear it and so forth. So, you know, I started talking with Dr. Gary Schwartz. I think Gary's been a guest on your show. And when I mentioned it to Gary, he said, well, let's do this. He says, let's design an experiment. He said, why don't you ask Fran, my wife, to contact Bailey, my daughter on the other side, and ask Bailey to contact this research medium. Her name was Janet Mayer. Her name is Janet Mayer, and she used to do research at the University of Arizona as one of Gary's research mediums. And he said, why don't you ask Fran to ask Bailey to go to Janet, and she should tell Janet, of course, Bailey being on the other side, if in fact that she is doing this Morse code. The following directions Fran did, she asked Bailey, she said, look, I need you to do something for me. I need you to go visit Janet Mayer, and I need you to be very, very specific. I need you to mention the words Morse code. Okay, the next day I go into my office, turn on my computer, open up my email, and the first email is from Gary. And what is it? It's a forward of an email that he received the first thing that morning from Janet. And the email said, Gary, I don't know what this is, I've never, ever experienced this before, but somebody is sending me Morse code. Now, you know, it takes a lot to get me, but I just about shrieked when I heard that because I just couldn't fathom how that was possible. So, you know, you reach, it's one of those one of the turning moments. Well, you could say, well, yes, that indeed was, you know, my daughter from the other side confirming it. Of course, others would say, well, this is just a form of telepathy, as if that was some easy task to perform, or some other type of so-called paranormal phenomena. But it certainly is one of those personal experiences that it's very, very hard to explain.
Have you ever yourself had a near-death experience?
No, and I am not intuitive in the least. I don't consider to have any ability with regards to telepathy or psi ability. However, I do have these dreams. You know, I would term them as dream visits. They're very different. I journal them all, and I've had something like 42 or 43 of them to date over the 5 years. And in these dreams, I see my daughter, and she talks to me, and I could hug her, and I can, you know, I can kiss her, and I could smell her, and I can. She's very often appears at different stages. I mean, she was 15 when she passed, but sometimes she's a young child, sometimes she's the actual age. And, you know, I reason it out perhaps since my mind is always going and I have a hard time quieting my mind, you know, so-called, you know, left brain, that maybe, you know, when my mind is at rest, my consciousness is at rest, I can, she's able to come through. So that's the only type of experience that I can relate to.
Yeah. The reason I asked, I think I told you, but I don't know if I did, but I had, what people, I didn't think of it as a near-death experience, really. I didn't think of it in terms like that, but I've had people tell me, yeah, that's what that was. I had a stroke, and then when I was in the emergency room, we reached a point where they were talking about me being unconscious, but I could hear everything that was going on, and yet what I was seeing around me, now, I was totally conscious of the fact that I had my eyes closed, but what I saw around me was I was in a circular white room, and I won't go into all the details. It wasn't any big, you know, I didn't hear choir singing, and I didn't see any, you know, light, you know, a tunnel of light or something like that. That didn't happen to me. But the point that I was going to make is that while I was there, I was conscious of what was happening here.
Yeah. And that is something that that's not unusual. You know, I mentioned to you we're having this conference out in San Francisco on the 19th and the 20th. We're going to have 10, you know, of these world-renowned speakers, and one of them is Bruce Grayson. Bruce is a medical doctor, and he's been studying these near-death experiences for 30 years. And as you say, you know, a lot of people have a misconception about the near-death experience because of the media. They think that everybody goes through a tunnel and then comes out into a white light, and you know that what actually some people do experience that, but the majority don't. But what you did, they do describe what you did, and that is of being in another place and being able to observe their own bodies. Sometimes they'll be in a hospital and they'll be up at the ceiling looking down, you know, and.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been some famous cases where people have been, you know, clinically dead, absolutely no reflexes, their heart stopped, no brain waves. And there's a famous case where a woman actually came back and described a shoe that was a sneaker, actually, that was on the ledge of one of the floors in the hospital that she saw when she was traveling out of body.
Bob, I hate to do it, but we're into a break, and it's going to shut your microphone and mine off. So we'll continue with this when we come back on the other side of the break. What do you think, folks? Is there life after life? And if so, is there evidence, real evidence, that it's real? We'll be back. We're talking this evening with Bob Ginsberg, and he is the founder of Forever Family Foundation. We're talking about survivability. When this physical life is over, what happens next? And he has approached this from a little bit different point of view than a lot of people do, in that he went out looking for real, solid, scientific evidence. And this came after the very tragic and sudden death of his daughter. Bob, you were telling us about this lady that had a near-death experience, and we had to cut off and go to the break. I want to give you time to finish that story.
Yeah, I think that the near-death experience offers some really solid evidence suggesting survival. You hear so many of these stories from the researchers about these people that travel, you know, out of body during these things, and sometimes they're life-changing experiences. They see deceased loved ones. Sometimes they enter different realms. They so-called travel through different time zones, if you would. And I think that, you know, a lot of people will criticize the near-death experience, and they'll say, well, it's just a product of the drugs that are administered during the procedures. But the research seems to show the opposite. The people that are given or administered drugs during certain procedures and then have a near-death experience, it doesn't happen. It inhibits the experience instead of enhancing it. Another criticism that you hear is that, well, it's just a product of a dying brain. It's a hallucination. But yet, you know, here you have people that all their systems are shut down. They have no sensory systems left. You know, as I said, they have flatlined EEGs, and you know, their hearts have stopped, and yet they describe these very vivid and sensory clear experiences. They don't seem hallucinatory. They're not jumbled. You know, they can describe every little detail of it, and they could remember it for the rest of their lives after they come back. So, especially when you find some hard empirical evidence, like I mentioned, was started to mention before about this patient who traveled, and when she awoke, she told people that she saw this sneaker that was on the ledge of one of the floors of the hospital, and then some of the people went out, and in fact, there it was, you know, when they opened the window and they saw the sneaker. So it seems that some of this evidence is hard to refute. You also have people that, actually, some of the researchers are doing experiments that way. They're putting signals or signs near the top of operating rooms on the theory that if you do have one of these near-death experiences and you are, in fact, traveling out of your body and looking down upon your body, then when you come back, you should be able to see the signal that was, or the sign that was written that, you know, on the top of some piece of machinery. Yeah, so it's very interesting work, and I think that's one area that offers a lot of potential. You know, mediumship is another area. You know, of course, it's when we talk about mediums, I mean, there are a lot of people that hang out a shingle today because of the popularity of different shows, and they call themselves mediums, and they're not. But mediumship research has been going on for, you know, well over 100 years, and some of the researchers today have set up laboratories where they set up very strict controlled conditions. They make sure that the sitter has no knowledge of the medium, and they score and the evidence, and they reach certain conclusions. We actually in the foundation, you know, copied some of these programs, and we run our own, you know, medium certification program. And I do the same thing. It's a scoring system. I educate the sitters on what to look for and how to score pieces of evidence that come up. They do readings for four different sitters and various types, in person, on the phone, email, and so forth. And then we evaluate the evidence. So, I mean, if you or I, not being mediums, just by sitting with somebody and doing a reading, we might guess and have an accuracy rating by chance of maybe 20 or 25%. So if somebody is hitting, you know, 80 or 85%, you know, well beyond the scope of chance, well, then you have something there.
As a matter of fact, Dr. Schwartz, Gary Schwartz, out at, I believe he's at ASU, isn't he?
University of Arizona.
University of Arizona, yeah. Has done that sort of thing in his lab. I've seen that on television. And he's some of the results have been quite surprising to him.
Yeah, you're right. He wrote the book, The Afterlife Experiments. He's also going to be one of the presenters at our San Francisco conference, and he helped me in designing our own certification program. So, he's done a lot of, there was a guy, as a matter of fact, that's really how I came to come upon all this stuff. I was in a waiting room waiting for where my son was being treated, and I took a break and I went next door to a bookstore, and the first book that I saw happened to be The Afterlife Experiment. So, I looked at it and I said, all right, maybe this is what I'm looking for. Here's a guy, he went to Harvard, he got his PhD from Harvard, he was a professor at Yale, he's got a PhD, he's no dummy, let me see what's going on there. So, I actually flew out there and looked at some of the stuff that he was doing, and not the mediumship research was new, but now some of the scientists were starting to try to replicate these studies, and it certainly is intriguing, especially when the information comes through that's very, very specific in nature. Not only that, sometimes the argument that the medium is only reading the sitter's mind, sometimes the medium gives information that's unknown to the sitter, and the sitter only finds it out, that it's true later on after investigating. So that would seem to indicate that they're not merely reading the sitter's mind.
In your research and in your work with mediums, have you been able to come up with any hypothesis or theory about what it is they are reading?
Yeah, it's always the hardest thing for a researcher is to try to determine whether or not the information that's coming through is coming through via psychic means or actually, communication with a discarnate entity. That's how do you, as a researcher, how do you tell the difference? Now, the good mediums tell you that they can differentiate. There's a totally different feeling because all mediums are psychic. So they can, pick up information psychically, but they describe a different kind of feeling, when they're talking with a discarnate. Now, it's not a two-way conversation. Some of them describe it as like a conversation underwater. They get certain signs and symbols and sometimes words. Sometimes they'll see a vision, they'll smell it, they'll feel something. But so the mechanism is nobody seems to know. Just how it's coming. Is the person on the other side, the discarnate entity, communicating, sending out a signal? Is it some sort of entanglement? My personal theory, and I have nothing to back it up, is that if these entities on the other side, being an entity of energy, somehow, make an imprint on the brain of the medium. Now, the medium may not realize that. The medium says, well, wait a second, did your loved one have a heart attack because I feel it in my chest? Well, what may be happening is that imprint was made of a heart attack into the brain of the medium, and then the medium, the brain, is taking over and sending signals to simulate, the feeling of a heart attack. So, I tend to think that it's some sort of an entanglement. Some people think that it's by frequency. Mediums talk about raising their frequency, and that, those on the other side lower their frequency, being in a much, higher vibrational state, and somehow, a match is made and communication is able to take place. But I have seen, both through our certification program and from personally, going to some mediums, some extraordinary things that you just walk out and you say to yourself, it's hard to believe, but I think that the data says that this is really happening. So the key is, in my mind, to determine how this process takes place, because if we could figure that out, and maybe that'll come through doing physiological tests, examining, you know, MRIs and so forth of the mediums. You know, maybe there'll be a way that we all can do this. We don't have to rely on mediums.
So you're not a medium yourself?
No, no, not at all. You know, I mean, I went into this totally distrusting mediums. I just didn't see any way how that would be possible. But, you know, Gary has a saying, you know, like, let the data speak. And that's the way I look at it. You know, for instance, when we were talking about personal experiences before, I consistently, every time something happening, even that incident with the Morse code, I would put it aside and say it's a coincidence, it's a coincidence, it's a coincidence. You know, one day, fortunately, I would journal all these things, and one day, after a couple of years, I looked at it, and I had, you know, 19 or 20 of these occurrences, and if you break them down, each one statistically, you know, having incredible odds, sometimes a million to one of happening. And when you have 19 or 20 million to one shots, then something in you has to say, well, you know what? Can't be coincidence anymore.
Something's going on.
Something's going on, you know, mm-hmm. And that's why it's important to look at all these things. I mean, there are so many different, for instance, at the conference, we have Fred Allen Wolf, you know, who's talking about this thing from the point of view of quantum physics and how it relates to the possibility that our soul, you know, continues on after we die. We have Jim Tucker, who's also a medical doctor, and he's talking about reincarnation, continuing the studies of Ian Stevenson, where they decades of research of children that have past life memories and some incredible things in the research come up. For, you know, for instance,
I hate to break in again, but we have to. We will be back on the other side of this break, folks, and we'll hear about children with past life memories and lots of other stuff. We'll be back right after this.
Around 5 a.m. Back to burning the blacktop again. This old road's gonna carry me home. Stopped in Jackson, called her on the telephone. Staying away is as hard as it seems. Following my heart, chasing my dreams. It feels like I'm
Did you know the Kevin Smith Show selects one of its very best shows each week and turns it into a free podcast? Well, it's true. You can download free Kevin Smith Show podcast right now and get a free fresh podcast each week. Do you want to start building your own library of Kevin Smith shows? All you have to do is visit our website at kevinsmithshow.com and click the free podcast link. They're yours for the download. We are back, and my guest this evening, Bob Ginsberg. We're talking about real evidence of life after life, or some people would say life after death. I call it life after life, Bob, because having been through what I went through, death, it was... I was in the process of dying, apparently. And I have to say, it's just another thing.
that should go on a T-shirt. It's just another thing.
Yeah, it. I mean... I have told other people this. Let me tell you that when I was having that experience where I was seeing myself as being in a circular white room. I was seated on the floor, my back against the wall, my knees were pulled up toward my chest, and my arms were wrapped around my knees. And I sat there, and I was really sort of ticked off. And I said, now, I don't know if people in the ER, I don't know if they heard me say anything, but I said in my consciousness at that point, I said, look, I know I'm going to die someday, but look, not today. I'm just too damn busy.
Did you get an answer?
No, but I began to, you know, on television, when you fade from one scene to another, how they sort of overlap?
Yes.
I experienced an overlap like that, and I was back into the ER.
Huh. So did you, what were some of the other sensory experiences you had? Was it just the recognition that you were in another place?
It was a little confusing because, yes, I was in another place, and the other place was a circular round room, and I was in there by myself, and I had the sensation and the knowledge that I was seated on the floor, my back against the wall, my knees pulled up to my chest, and my arms wrapped around my knees. And there was all that. At the same time, I could hear everything that was happening in the ER.
Yeah.
So I wasn't separated from the ER completely.
Yeah. Were you fearful at all?
No.
Were you,
No, I had no... like I said, the best way I can describe how I felt was, it's just another thing, and it's not a thing I want to do today.
Right.
You know,
you're going to do it eventually, but just not then.
Not right now. I had too much going on. And, I kind of chuckle about it now, and everybody that I tell it to kind of chuckles about it. But at the time, I really was just frustrated that, you know, look, I am busy. I've got a lot of things I need to do, and this is holding me up.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people that have these experiences describe, encountering an actual being, whether it be, it varies by culture. Some, think they see a religious figure, and some think they just see some, anomalous, energy. But they describe having a conversation, and then this entity saying, well, it's not your time yet, and the people saying, well, it's so beautiful or whatever, I want to stay. And say, no, it's not your time. And then, whooshing back into their body that's wrecked with pain. Yours was not that kind of a full, blown type of...
Uh-uh.
experience, but it's not uncommon, you know, in these accounts. You know, a lot of people seem to describe that knowledge of they're not in their bodies, but that they're going to go back to their bodies, you know.
Well, I was aware that I was not in my body.
Yep.
I was aware of that. But I didn't have one of those hovering above my body and watching it and things like that. That didn't happen.
Yeah.
My point in telling the story was that I guess, you know, everyone would have their own description of the death experience. Mine, I have to say, if that's what death is, if that's what was going on there, it's just another thing. And as you go through it, it's all of the fear and apprehension people have on this side regarding death. As you go through that, it's not there. It's just another thing you do.
Yeah, a lot of people do describe it that way. Also, saying you know, they describe it as a birth. You know, you're being reborn from a physical existence to a different type of dimension. But it's just a transition, like they describe it, like stepping through a door. And many people do lose their fear of death. You know, after going through something like that, because it's, as you say, it's just another thing.
Yeah. Now, I don't like pain, and I don't like to feel sick, to feel ill, which I certainly felt when I was having the stroke. I was very ill. I don't like to feel that I'm out of control of my body. You know, I like to be very much in control. I had eye surgery years ago, and I had it without anesthesia because of the job that I was doing at the time. I could not afford to be knocked out. And so, as a result of that, the doctor was quite amazed because I said, okay, just give me a few seconds here, and I will tell you when I'm ready for you to start cutting. And I got my mind prepared for the pain, and I dealt with it. It hurt, but I dealt with it. My point is that I understand pain. I know what it feels like. I don't like it. However, if what I experienced was a near-death experience, once you start into that, that sense of pain and illness and all of that was not there. It that body laying in there in the ER was sick, but I wasn't.
Yeah, there you go. Because you didn't feel pain because you left your physical body for that period of time. It would seem, you know, some might say you were straddling two different worlds, but. Fact is, you didn't have the bodily sensations because you were able to, you, meaning your consciousness, your mind, you know, left your body, you know, your shell. I mean, that's the way a lot of people would describe it.
Mm-hmm. Now, having been through that, and again, you know, what I experienced doesn't seem to match up with what a lot of other people experience in near-death experiences. However, I've been told by, as a matter of fact, do you know Daniel Brinkley?
Yeah.
He and I talked about it, and he said, yeah, that is a near-death experience. And so, okay, well, there it is. And so I've experienced it. That still is not any sort of real proof or evidence. It's just me saying that this is what happened to me. And your foundation has been focused on looking for and documenting evidence.
Well, that's true, you know, and we'd like to say that, you know, we hope that one day that science will be able to prove an afterlife. A lot of people will say, well, that's not possible, and maybe it's not. You know, perhaps Some will say, well, we were never meant to be able to prove it. But just logically, it seems to me if we have this evidence that comes through of these people on the other side that are trying to communicate, I don't buy the argument that we weren't meant to. You know, another area of evidence that's gaining more and more acceptance now as we become more technologically advanced is this EVP, electronic voice phenomena. And what's intriguing about that is it's not anecdotal. We're talking about hard evidence that we can pick up with our five senses. I mean, we could hear sounds on tape. You know, some of them, I would discount because I can't understand what's being said, so therefore you discount it. But others are very, very clear with specific messages, very short in duration, you know, a couple of seconds, you know, at the most. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, you know, specific messages, and that's intriguing. You know, somehow that's another area to investigate. I mean, how could, an entity of energy without a voice box, you know, make a voice imprint on a piece of tape? And that is a mystery, you know. It has another, maybe, is that some sort of entanglement or...
Yeah. We're into another break, Bob, and when we come back on the other side of this one, we'll have quite a long time before the next break. All right, folks, we'll be back right after this. Most of the great music you hear right here on Steel Eye Media Network is supplied by the independent artists from GarageBand.com. If you hear a song you like, go over to GarageBand.com, look it up, download it. You can even buy the group's CDs, in many cases, right there at GarageBand.com.
Woke up this morning, had a strong desire to get this out. Never had the struggle to understand just what life's about. When I hold my six-string, I close my eyes and I absorb. Just have to figure out the secrets of the magic door. I'm tough, so I huff and I puff and I'm smooth, so I smile. I believe.
Kevin Smith Show at 1-800-289-1092.
We are back, and we are into the part of the show where we open up the telephone lines. And let me just say this for all of you who are new. You've not been exposed by new. I mean, you're listening for the first time right now. You've not been exposed to Kevinisms before, and I have a very important Kevinism for you, all right? Here it is. Those people who think you don't matter don't matter. What does matter is that here at the Kevin Smith Show, you matter. All right. And we want to hear from you. The telephone number is 1-800-289-1092. 1-800-289-1092. I pay for the call throughout North America. That's a toll-free number for the United States and Canada. All right. If you live outside of North America, you still matter. We want to hear from you. So if you're outside of North America, you can send me a flash message. Just send an email with your question or comment and send it to flash, F-L-A-S-H, at kevinsmithshow.com. Bob, it seems like we always have to cut away right in the middle of good stuff, but that happens when those breaks, they're automated. When they take over, they take over, and it shuts you and me down.
I understand. Got to pay the bills.
I wish it paid the bills.
Yeah, I hear you.
And I'm hoping that in 2008 it will pay the bills. If it does, it'll be the first time in the 7-year history of the show. So, yeah. Anyway, the whole thing about death, you know, a lot of people that I've talked to over the years are really nervous about talking about death. I mean, that topic scares people off. Do you run into that?
Absolutely. You're right on target with that. And people, you know, we live in a society that wants to sweep death under the rug. I mean, look at what we do. We do everything to make ourselves look younger, you know, to accumulate as much as we can, you know, new toys, forever young, you know, we're going to live eternal. Nobody thinks of it, you know, which it's not the same in different cultures, you know, throughout the world. You know, perhaps... you know, we should be thinking more in terms of what we do in this physical existence. If there is an afterlife, it may affect our continuance in that other dimension, you know, and maybe we would live our lives a little differently. But certainly, you're absolutely right. I mean, nobody wants to talk about death. I mean, I find as a grieving parent, I mean, most of the friends that I had, you know, it's like they're going to catch some sort of disease, you know. So it's a topic that we avoid at all costs. And just think, maybe this physical existence is just, you know, it just all continues. It's just a little blip in a much greater, cycle of existence. So, and when we get there, we see how foolish we were, to think of it in such a horrible terms.
Yeah. You know, when you're born, there's an invisible tattoo right on your butt when you're born, and it says guaranteed to die. It's the only guarantee you get here with. Let's go to the telephone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? I see. All right. 1-800-289-1092. 1-800-289-1092. It's a toll-free call, but when I put you on hold, don't do that to me, please. All right. Death is the only guarantee that we arrive on this planet in possession of. And yet it's the thing that we seem to run from. And you can't run from it. From the day you're born, you begin to die.
That's true, and a lot of mental health workers and doctors now are starting to, when they deal with people in like in hospice situations, for instance, they don't isolate the patient. You know, they talk to the patient. They talk about the patient's fears. They talk about experiences. One of the things that we do as a foundation is we run these afterlife discussion groups throughout the country, and they're just small groups, and they're open environments where people can talk about various phenomena, such as the things we were talking about tonight. And I often thought it would be valuable to run one of those groups in a hospice if they would allow it, because those people, a lot of the people in there that have a terminal disease must be very fearful, and just listening to some of the evidence, in a clear fashion, help them in some way. But that brings
up. Well, I think a lot of people, what they're afraid of is they're afraid of the unknown, and I think it's very important for people who have had a near-death experience to share that, because while it may not be complete information, it at least is some information and takes away some of the unknown. And makes part of it known. So I think it's very important to share that with people, especially in a hospice situation. Let's try to go back to the telephone. And caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
This is Dale calling from New York.
Yes, Dale.
Hi.
Hi, welcome aboard.
Thank you. I just have a comment. I have a good friend of mine who was involved in a serious auto accident in his 20s, and it was so bad they had problems finding his body. Turns out he was wrapped up in 30 feet of guardrail, and they didn't expect him to live. And he told me, and somehow we got onto the same subject, your discussion, he told me that what he experienced was the tunnel, and he was proceeding down the tunnel, saw the light, and then in the light there was an image of a person waving him back, giving him a signal not to come through the tunnel, and the next thing you know, he wakes up in severe pain and survives, obviously. So I just thought maybe Bob would like to comment on that.
Yeah, we touched on that before. A lot of people describe a similar experience where, there you had one of the classic ones with the tunnel and a light and another entity, and the entity is sort of, I guess from what you were saying, they were sort of pushing him back or telling him that he's got to go back. Now, of course, why was he being told that he had to go back, and then eventually he passed on?
No, he didn't. He's
he didn't.
Alive
okay.
Today.
Yeah.
Good
so,
friend.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people will talk when I often think about that when we're told that we have more work to do or it's not our time. Does that mean that people talk about lessons that we still have to learn or that things that we still have to accomplish? So that would tend to indicate some sort of an orderly fashion to the universe or some plan that somebody has. But it's not an uncommon experience that you just related. It's very interesting, and he didn't recognize that the other entity that was sending him back, did he?
No, he said he couldn't make them out.
Yeah.
How did it affect you, Dale?
How did it affect me?
Yeah. When you heard about this, what kind of an effect did it have on you?
Well, I had been doing my own research in the subject long before he ever told me the story. I had been waiting to run into somebody that actually had the experience, and now I have.
And would you say that it had any effect on you, that it changed you in any way to hear it?
It was like a confirmation of what I feel personally, I'd say.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. How did it change him?
I have one other comment.
Well, Bob asked you a question. I don't think that you were able to hear it. He said, how did it change him?
Huh. Well, I tell you what, he's going through some difficult times now physically.
Yeah.
Because he abused himself a lot. And, he's always been a person, despite his idiosyncrasies, that has always been willing to help somebody else. you know, even and never expect anything in return. And that's his most endearing trait. That's why I feel so close to him.
All right. You said you had another question or comment?
I'll make it real quick.
Uh-huh.
You know, I've heard statements from some scientists about how the sense of smell can jog memory.
Mm-hmm.
And a few years ago when my mother passed away, we know how people have a certain scent. Now, I'm not talking about body odor. I'm talking about a scent.
Yeah.
All mammals have a scent.
Mm-hmm.
And I recall this from the time I was a child being close to my mother. When she passed away and I had to go to her apartment and take care of all that stuff. Now, the minute I walked into the apartment after she had passed, I felt, I sensed that scent, that overwhelming scent. And I got the impression that, don't worry, everything's fine. Now, maybe it's wishful thinking, but that's how I interpreted it. What do you think about that, Bob?
You know, and that's also not uncommon. A lot of people that have, you know, so-called after-death communications and spontaneous communications often report, you know, the smelling the scent, you know, of a loved one. You know, I had my own experience, you know, with that. I had my wife one day woke up because she smelled smoke in the house, and she went all throughout the three floors in the house and couldn't find anything, and she unplugged the toaster oven, and she didn't see the smoke, but the smell permeated the house, and we just couldn't figure it out. This is before we investigated mediums and before we formed the foundation, and we went to see a medium you may have heard of in Manhattan, you know, Suzanne Northrup, and I, you know, went there sort of, you know, open-minded, but I didn't know whether I believed in anything. And then she looked at my wife, and she said, "Your daughter is here, and she's telling me that when you smell smoke in your house, that's her." And this was only a couple of days after that incident. So I can certainly relate to what you're saying.
Dale, I want to thank you for the call. I appreciate it. 1-800-289-1092. Danny and Brent and Lewis, you were trying to get through, and the phone line is open. 1-800-289-1092. Toll free throughout North America. All right, caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, this is Bob from California.
Bob, welcome aboard.
How's it going, Kevin?
Outstanding. What's on your mind?
Well, I just was wondering, as far as all that NDE research, how many people, percentage-wise, have had these experiences as far as your guest has found?
Well, I don't have the exact statistics, and, you know, I'm not a scientist. However, I can tell you that, you know, out of people that are in similar experiences when they're close to death, I think the figure is somewhere around 10%. I mean, you know, we're taught to, you know, a lot of people are under the misconception that, you know, everybody has one, and that's not true. I think that people that are close to death and have these serious illnesses or accidents, or think that they're about to die, you know, have these near-death experiences, but I think that the accurate figure is somewhere around a 10 or 11%.
That sounds like it's probably true. I just have one question, and I'm going to hang up.
All right.
What percentage of people do you think that have these experiences actually report them, so to speak, or hide them because they're afraid of scientific community and people making fun of them?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I would venture a guess that an awful lot of them, because you know, their own doctors very often not open. They don't want to get labeled as being psychotic or hallucinating, and it's sometimes they just need some time to sort it out. Very often they say nothing, and then a few years later is when they first start to talk about it.
All right, thanks, Bob. We appreciate the call. 1-800-289-1092. If you're outside of North America, you can send a flash message. Just send a regular email with your question or comment and send it to flash@kevinsmithshow.com. All right, fair enough. Let's go back to the telephone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
This is Brent from Wyoming.
Yes, Brent, go ahead.
I have a question for you. First, I want to thank you for having this show, Kevin, but my question is this. How long after somebody passes over until they're able to communicate or, you know, get a message through on average? Or have you studied that yet?
Well, you know, I've asked that question myself of various, you know, mediums, and they pretty much say, you know, there's no set time. It's very often it's immediate. Most of the communication seems to occur more frequently in a short period of time surrounding somebody's passing. When I say short, I mean, you know, 6 months, a year, you know, and sometimes it seems to wane after that, although it's not uncommon to have communication after, you know, an hour time, 30, 40, 50 years. But very often, especially in the cases of where children have passed, the communication, you know, seems to be immediate.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Brent. 1-800-289-1092. That's toll-free. And we have a flash message. It's pretty long from Australia. I will read parts of it. I've scanned through it. I'll read the salient parts. The more I look into it, caller, if you will, just hold, and I will be with you in a moment. The more I look into it, the more it seems like our brains work like an antenna to the etheric realms. In short, thought is energy. The law of conservation of energy states that energy cannot be created or destroyed. It can only be changed from one form to another. In saying this, I think our brains work with higher planes we are not receptive to when we are in the awakened conscious state. Then he goes on to say, it sounds like that your dreams that you talked about are what are called lucid dreams. And then he mentions several good mediums that have impressed him. And then it says, I truly believe in the afterlife. I've had a dance with the Reaper twice in my life. The worst was when a car hit me head on whilst I was riding a motorcycle. It was not my time to go. I had things to do. Man, do I understand that. And by the way, I'll give you my motorcycle incident in a moment. Even though I had an interest in the paranormal beforehand, after the last accident, I'm very receptive to things. I won't go into it today as I don't want to take up any more of your time today. Thank you for your time. Cheers, Andrew. Interesting. I used to be an international police officer, and I was stationed on an island where the best way to get around was with a motorbike, because we didn't have roads. Very often the places we had to go were what I called pig trails through the jungle. I was on one of the roads we had that was went up around the side of a mountain, and I was at a point where we had about 100-foot drop down to the river. I rounded the curve, and as I did, there was another motorcycle coming the other way in my lane, and he hit me. And it popped me right off my motorbike, and I went over the cliff. And the reason I'm telling you this, it was not, I guess it was a near-death experience, but about 30 feet down, there were some just scrub brush things growing out of the cliff, and they had vines growing through them, and it caught me like a net. But when I went over the cliff, I had exactly the same thought, the same sensation as I had when I had the stroke, and that was, damn, I've got things to do.
It's amazing during these things how time seems to slow down, and you can have these, you know, these lucid thoughts at a time when you would think you'd be panicking and, you know, and freaking out.
I was instantly aware that I had no control over this. I was going over the cliff. There was nothing I could do about it, and I thought, damn, I've got things I have to do today. All right, let's go back to the phone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hello, this is Louis Kevin from Connecticut.
And Louis.
Kevin, and good evening, Bob.
Hi. Hi, Louis.
How you doing? I believe that our brain is a secondary memory. Our soul is a primary memory. And the universe is the main database. And I believe all families are on the same frequency, so when we die, everything we do every day, our secondary, our brain, transmits everything to our soul. When we die, our soul leaves the body, and at a certain frequency, I think whoever assigns to each family, and the soul leaves the body, and our relative picks up that frequency and talks to the soul, and that's how we get our communication after life, after death.
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't disagree with that. I mean, you know, people, you talk about souls, you can say consciousness instead of souls, but certainly a lot of people will say that we seem to be traveling groups, you know, a part of different soul groups. It's interesting when you talk about the frequency, you know, because scientists today talk about string theory, right? The basic elements of life are actually these vibrating strings, and not only are they always vibrating, they're never at rest, but they vibrate at different rates of frequency. And perhaps people that are in our family or soul groups, can tap into that same frequency. So I don't really disagree with anything that you said.
Right. Now, here's an example, Bob. I don't know if you know about, like, a scanner and
right.
A cordless phone, okay? Usually a cordless phone is assigned X amount of frequencies. If you take a regular programmable scanner that you can pick up in an electronics store, and you assign, you go on to a cordless phone, and you keep on saying, like, testing 1, 2, 3, and there are so many frequencies assigned to that cordless phone, when you get the right frequency, you're going to hear yourself say, testing 1, 2, 3. So once you hang up, it released it. Every time that caller phone rings now, you're going to hear the conversation on the scanner because you got the right frequency.
Yeah, and frequency might be able, these different frequencies might be able to be stored, you know, in this invisible field that we can't see, and they can be, this information, you know, can be retrieved by just, you know, tapping into that same frequency again.
Believe that. That's why I believe, remote viewing is the top of your record, and I believe the universe has different frequencies for everything.
Well, it may be. It that makes some sense. It sure does. Louis, thank you for the call.
Thank you. Good evening, gentlemen.
All right.
Good evening.
Well, you can tell that this is a topic that is hitting some chords because, our callers have been from all over the country so far. We've had New York and California. That's the left and the right coast.
Right.
Wyoming in the middle, Connecticut up in the northeast. And we want to hear from you, ladies and gentlemen, wherever you are. Death is near and dear to us all. You can't run from it. I don't care what direction you run, you're running toward it. And for those who are afraid of it, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but you are guaranteed not to get off this planet alive, all right? And I think it's important for us to think about, okay, then what? Once it happens, you're guaranteed that it's going to happen, then what? What happens next? Or is there a next? You know, you were talking earlier, Bob, about scientists working to try and establish some sort of scientific proof that there is life after death, that our consciousness continues to survive and exist after death. You know, that's a tall order because, truthfully, they can't even establish what is the proof that there is life right now. And a good case for that is Terry Schiavo. Remember the big debate?
Yeah.
I mean, and, you know, we've talked on this show a lot about how to prove things. You know, I can actually go into court and prove you don't exist.
That's right. And science, what they do is they keep changing the definition of death as they do more and more research. You know, it's changed a lot since then, you know, what the definition of death was, you know, 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah, it's a moving target now.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. And so, this, you know, I think it's important for them to do the work, but I'm not sure that it's important for us to look for proof. Because you see my point? They can't even really prove that there is life.
I know, and I think that ultimately the proof can only come from within. You know, I mean, if you have certain experiences, if you're able to tap in personally to some of these other, you know, realms, that's your personal proof. And that.
All right, we're into a break, and we'll be back on the other side of this break. More with Bob Ginsberg and with your calls to 1-800-289-1092. We will be back. Get it all. Become a member at kevinsmithshow.com.
Call the Kevin Smith Show at 1-800-289-1092.
don't forget to join us in the chat room. Don't forget to join me in the chat room on Saturday evening in the members area, all right? I'm looking forward to chatting with you all right? We're talking with Bob Ginsberg, and we're talking about the most guaranteed thing in this life, and that is death and what happens beyond it. One of the thoughts that I had, we're talking about you can't really prove that life exists. We accept that it does. The fact that you can't logically nail it down and prove it speaks more to our frailties of logic than anything else. We don't know how to define life, therefore we can't really prove that it exists because we can't really define it too well. But we all accept that we have life, and we experience it. We know that we have life, even if the scientists can't define it and prove it, we know it. And I think that may be one real good example about how we need to approach this thing about life after this life. Maybe they can't nail it down or define it or rationally explain it, and yet there are lots of people that have experienced it. Now, one of the things that I hear about, see, I'm not a religious person, and a lot of people have concluded that since I'm not religious, I must be an atheist. And that is very erroneous. But one of the things that I came away from all of this with, and it's an opinion that it's been developing over a number of years, is that I'm willing to say that God is very real, but not very religious. Now, having said that, you mentioned something earlier about people having near-death experiences, and you said something about what they experience depends upon what their religious background is and their culture and so forth. Why is that?
Well, you know, when we talk about our brains, I mean, we have stored memories and we have cultural influences. Now, what the research shows is that when we're talking about near-death experience, I mean, somebody living in Asia, might see Buddha, somebody describe, very often somebody that's brought up in the Christian faith describes seeing Jesus, and some people describe, seeing, Muhammad, and you wonder how... how is this possible, and the answer is that I would imagine that while you're having the experience, you encounter something, and then your conscious, mind starts to take over and interpret it, based upon the way that you were brought up and what you were taught to believe. That's the only explanation I can think of why people would see all different types of religious figures. Some don't see a religious figure at all. Some just describe this energy, a loving energy, and that's the way they describe it. But certainly, cultural and religious affiliations seem to affect these types of experiences.
I had one lady that wrote in after I had described the white room and all of that, and I didn't see anybody, I didn't see a light and all that. And she wrote in and said, "That's proof of what I've been telling you." She's written to me before and said that I'm the spawn of Satan. And she said, "That's proof of what I've been telling you. You were in hell's waiting room." Now, I have to ask this. What about near-death experiences where people see hell? Does that happen?
It does. It's infrequent, but there are a certain percentage of people that have bad experiences, so to speak, when they have a near-death experience. The overwhelming majority, probably 90% of them are very positive, but 10% of them, people describe maybe not necessarily a hell, but a hellish type of experience, and we don't know the reasons for that. I mean, it could be conscious interpretation, or it could be some things that were weighing on their mind or deeds that they have done. I mean, who knows? But yeah, I mean, the media would lead you to believe that, you know, everybody sees this glowing, you know, white light and everything's all, you know, beautiful and hunky dory. But there is as you mentioned, there are a percentage of people that have, you know, a hellish type of experience.
Either way, it speaks to the fact that consciousness continues. Whether you see, you know, this wonderful white light, and you hear the angels singing, and you know everything is wonderful, or whether you have this very frightening experience, either way, the evidence suggests that consciousness continues.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. And I mean, I always took that approach when I went to these demonstrations of mediumship. You know, you would think, well, you know, everybody wants to hear from their own loved one. But I'm sitting there thinking, if the medium is giving the person next to me, you know, evidence, and the evidence seems to be very specific and it's corroborated and it's real, well, you know, if that person's loved one survives, that means mine does too, you know. Mm-hmm. And just as you say, whether you have an experience in the near-death experience, good or bad, it still means that your consciousness is continuing on, even when you're physically dead.
How difficult was it for you, as you worked through the grief, how difficult was it for you to come to grips with the fact and to be able to say that your daughter was no longer with you physically? That, I mean, how difficult was it to accept that fact?
Well, it's, you know, I mean, there's no way to describe it. It's you know, it takes over your life. I mean, life as I knew it ended that day. You know, I have a new life now. Some people, you know, they don't come out of it. They don't find a way to navigate their lives after that, and some people do. You know, I think that if I didn't examine all this evidence and come to a conclusion in my head that there is an afterlife, I'd be in a very different place right now. I mean, I might be sitting in a corner drooling, or sitting in a hospital. I mean, it's you don't really, your life blows apart, and you really. It's a desperate search for meaning. Now, for me, that search took the form of, give me evidence, give me evidence. It's not enough to tell me stories. I want to, you know, form this opinion on my own. And that's the quest that I took, you know, and I think that I'm in a much better place having come to the logical conclusion in my mind that that our consciousness continues. So I think that even today, a lot of psychologists and psychiatrists are learning that a belief in survival of consciousness or an afterlife is a very effective form of grief therapy. Now, they don't necessarily care whether it's true or not. All they care about is that they see the difference in their patients.
Oh, yeah. I would think so, yeah. Let's go back to the telephone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. First name and where are you calling from?
This is Michelle from Quebec.
Yes, Michelle.
Good evening, Kevin.
Good evening.
Good evening, Bob.
Good evening.
Okay, Kevin, you were saying memory after death, and he was telling about Jesus and Buddha and whatever all over. Wouldn't that be genetic memory?
Oh, I don't know.
No, but
man, I mean, I had the experience that I had, and I can't explain it.
But wouldn't that be proof that there is genetic memory? Because every case you hear about, they talk about what happened to them then, and if they come back, and when, like in, what is it, Tibet, the monks, they always look for children that remember their past lives, and because they remember. Pushing toward, don't you think there should be more study on genetic memory?
Well, I think so. What do you think, Bob?
Yeah, I mean, the one theory is that, you know, somehow this is encoded in our DNA, and that certainly is one of the arguments in this reincarnation research when you talk about, you know, past life memories. the way that they research these things, you know, it's really up your alley, Kevin, because it's investigative work. Mm-hmm. These researchers are investigators. I mean, somebody has a past life memory, and they let's say a child describes being this other person and gives specific evidence about this person, the age, where they lived, their wife's name, you know, what they did for a living. And then the researcher goes out and investigates, finds this person, looks up medical records and so forth, and sometimes it's the evidence is pretty convincing when they find, especially in cases of birthmarks. You know, there are some famous cases where the child describes being this other person, and they find out that this other person in a past life was involved in a crime and was shot, for instance. Like, let's say you were shot 3-4 times in the chest. And then they look at the child, and the child has birthmarks in all the corresponding spots, you know, as evidenced by the medical reports, you know, during the autopsy. So that kind of stuff is pretty interesting. But then you have to say, how does that happen? You know, well, you know, is it some sort of a genetic imprint, you know, that manifests itself in a birthmark? You know, it's intriguing.
It is intriguing. Michelle, thank you so much for the call. We're up against a break, and we're going to have to allow it to do what it does. There's a very famous child right now in Russia, and I think his name is Boriska or Borishka, and all of his past life memories have to do with when he lived many, many, many thousands of years ago on Mars. And there have been all kinds of scientists and psychologists and researchers, all kinds of people, taking a look at this child and interviewing him. And they've just come to the conclusion that he is remembering, and maybe he was there. Pretty bizarre stuff. All right, we'll be back right after this.
get it all. Become a member at kevinsmithshow.com.
Call the Kevin Smith Show at 1-800-289-1092.
We are back and we are on Final Approach. We have time for a couple of more calls at 1-800-289-1092. My guest, Bob Ginsberg. And let me remind you that Saturday evening I'll be in the chat room in the members area, and I hope to see you there and get an opportunity to chat with you and sort of meet you personally online a little bit. All right, let's go back to Bob Ginsberg. And Bob, I mentioned this Boriska, which means little Boris. Have you heard about this child? Have you read anything about him?
No, I haven't. No, I you said that he's remembering a past life, but it took place on Mars, right?
Yeah, and you know, at first that sounds a little bizarre, but you know, they've done all kinds of tests on this kid, and a lot of the stuff that he says, there's no way a child his age. He's been doing that, talking about this since he was about 3.
Yeah.
And he's now 10, and there's no way a child at those ages could know the details that he knows, and they're accurate details about Mars.
Well, perhaps our scientists should be embracing this kid and taking the attitude of learning about stuff they've been seeking answers for.
Yeah, they could learn it without a rover.
Yeah.
All right. Now, I want to talk about this conference that you're having. Why the conference? What's up with that? Come to this conference, what do I get out of it?
Well, you know what, we thought that, you know, we've been in existence since 2004. And incidentally, if I could mention all these topics we've been talking about, you know, people can find more information on our website, which is foreverfamilyfoundation.org. But we felt that, you know, that the media, it's so hard to get the media involved. You know, a lot of these topics, as we were talking about before, death as a topic, you know, people don't want to talk about. But yet, the questions we get all the time, you know, from our members, you know, all over the world is, you know, what happens after we die? You know, does our consciousness survive, you know, our physical death? So what we've done is we've put together people, we're coming at you from all angles in the San Francisco conference, which takes place this month on the 19th and 20th, and the information is also on our website. So we've taken people from the world of quantum physics, from mediumship, near-death experiences, reincarnation. Dean Radin, who talks about, you know, consciousness and psi-related phenomena, telepathy, and so forth. Arthur Hastings, who does research with the psychomantium. You know, Diane Archangel, who wrote a book about, you know, afterlife encounters. Lloyd Auerbach, I know you've had him on your show. Paranormal investigator. You know, so we're, plus we have two mediums, Robert Brown and Hollister Rand, alongside of these scientists, because I think their evidence is just as important. So what we're doing is we're coming at you from all different angles, asking these presenters to present, you know, their latest evidence. And we want people, we're not trying to beat you over the head, but we want you to walk away with information and saying, well, you know, form your own opinion. These are all, this is all evidence that our consciousness, you know, can, you know, act independently, you know, of our brains. Now, does it prove there's an afterlife? No, but it's a question of opening your mind and forming opinions based upon what you hear. And we put them all together in one spot. You know, I don't know if it's been done before. I mean, these people have never been together. There have been scientific conferences, but this is geared towards, you know, general audiences. So we're really excited about it. You know, we hope people will come out, and we're trying to get the media to cover this, and it's not an easy task.
Well, you're in America.
Yeah.
And trying to get American media to do anything serious and accurate is
these days, it's living in a fantasy world because they live in a fantasy world. The media in this country is in deplorable condition. But I do wish you the best with it. I hope it works. I hope you're able to get the media involved. Mass media, major media, mainstream media in the United States is in absolutely deplorable shambles. And I don't hold out much hope for them.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. I mean, it's a it's all about numbers and ratings and audience.
Right, and what's happening with Britney?
Right.
Like, funny. Who gives a rat's rear?
Yeah.
You know,
it's incredible.
But now you know the focus has shifted. Now it's no longer the focus is not on Britney now. It's on her younger sister. So
right.
There's been a change.
Yeah, and 2 weeks it'll be on something else. Yeah.
Yeah. The really important issues of life, of course. But I do hope that you are able to attract the attention of the major media, and if nothing else, and this could be a good start, it could be a crack in the ice. Would be if some of the major media, local major media in San Francisco, will pick up on this. And I would think that would be the sort of city that would pick up on this and report it reasonably and responsibly in their own local media. Because it's a major market, and if that happens, that could be a crack in the ice for the, you know, getting into the national media for the future.
Yeah, that's what we were hoping. You know, it is a 2-day conference, and you know, people, will be coming in from all different parts of the country, but we're hoping that the people in San Francisco will also, you know, come out. And take part in this, because I think it'll be a very rewarding experience.
Yeah, but again, the fact is, media has their fingers on the pulse of the buying public, the demographics that they serve, and they quite certainly are aware that death is not a real popular subject.
Well, there we go back to trying to avoid it. But then, but when you ask the question of people, what happens after we die, you know, ears pick up. Everybody wants to know.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's, you know, it's pretty universal. It's death, of course, is universal. But it's pretty universal for people to be curious about, well, what happens later. So maybe there's some hope there for the media out in San Francisco. I know we have listeners in San Francisco because I've had callers from there, and I would suggest to our listeners out in the San Francisco area that write to your newspaper, write to the TV stations, write to the radio stations that you listen to or that you watch, and request that they cover this conference. That would be a tremendous help. They are responsive when they get requests, when they get written requests. You have to sign your name to it. If you send it anonymously, they will not respond to it at all. It'll go straight to the trash can. But sign your name to it and request that they cover this conference. I think it will make a great contribution to the body of knowledge that people have about who we are. We did a show within the last couple of weeks where we just asked the question, who are we really? What are we? And that's a big question in itself. We know we exist, but we don't even know who we are, what we are.
Yeah, so many people think of themselves as their physical bodies. That's how they identify themselves. You know, they're 6 foot and they have black hair, and you know, and that's them. You know, but there are others that think of themselves quite differently. You know, as you know, as some entity of thought that's aware of things, you know, and it's all about perspective.
It is indeed. Bob Ginsberg, I want to thank you for being with us this evening. If you will, just stay on the phone with me for a little bit. And folks, there you have it. What happens after we leave this life? Important, interesting, for some people frightening. But I got to say, I found the information tonight to be enlightening. All right. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. I'll be back tomorrow night. You be here too, okay? Until then, so long, everybody.